This is Not Your Grandma's Bible Study, making critical biblical scholarship accessible and fun.
Hi, and welcome to Not Your Grandma's Bible Study. I'm Jill, and I'm not your grandma. Thanks for listening. Today we're going to look into the genre known as rewritten Bible. We'll begin by doing a little overview of the history of the Dead Sea Scrolls, since many rewritten texts were discovered there. Then we'll consider questions around the appropriateness of the term rewritten Bible, what features need to be present for a document to earn this classification, and what canonical texts fall into this category. Although I am a New Testament scholar, I did my minor in Jewish studies. One of my qualifying exam questions was about the genre of rewritten Bible, and a lot of this episode is pulled from that research. That being said, to my Jewish literature listeners, if I make any egregious mistakes or miss anything important, please feel free to email me at notyourgrandmapodcast@gmail.com and let me know. All I ask is a little grace and kindness from you. All right, let's get into it. The Dead Sea Scrolls are a collection of documents concerned with Jewish folk and their God, as well as Jewish practices. These documents date between the 3rd century BCE and the destruction of the Jerusalem Temple by Rome in 70 CE. The initial discovery was made by Muhammad Adib, a member of the Ta'amira Bedouin tribe, and at least one companion in a cave near the Dead Sea. The initial discovery included the oldest known complete manuscript of Isaiah, a rule book for the community, and a commentary on Habakkuk. Several other scrolls were discovered before archaeologists began excavation of the area in February and March of 1949. In all, 11 caves were excavated, as well as other peripheral sites. In many ways, the scrolls are representative of what was held common by the various sects in Judaism around the turn of the era. With the exception of Esther, the entirety of what is now the Hebrew Bible is represented, though some are only fragments. It is hard to know whether Esther's omission was intentional or is merely an accident of history. Some other previously known but non-canonical texts were also discovered, including 1st Enoch and Jubilees. There were also some clearly sectarian writings discovered. These include such texts as the Community Rule, which is a manual of discipline for the community, calendrical texts that follow a solar rather than a lunar calendar, the War Scroll, which is an apocalyptic manual, quote-unquote, regarding the final imminent battle between the sons of light and the sons of darkness. There are also some commentaries, known as Pesharim, or Pesher, in the singular, that tend to be sectarian in their interpretation. The scrolls shed valuable light on the historical context of Second Temple Judaism. First, many scholars maintain that the discovery of the sectarian scrolls provide information on the Essenes, a major Jewish sect at the turn of the era. Until the discovery of the scrolls, the Essenes were a mystery and known only through other writings of the time. No documents written by the Essenes were known to exist prior to the discovery of the scrolls. Second, the discovery of the complete Isaiah text was valuable for the field of textual criticism. Textual critics were able to compare the varying traditions of the Masoretic text, the Samaritan Pentateuch, and the scrolls with what would become canonical scripture. Further, as already alluded to, the scrolls helped to clarify what were quote-unquote, universal characteristics of early Judaism, and what contributed to making each sect unique. Finally, the scrolls are the only documents available in Hebrew or Aramaic from Judea between the time of the Maccabees and the rise of Rabbinic Judaism. Publication of the scrolls was a lengthy process. For the first 40 years or so, the scrolls were only accessible to a small editorial team of international scholars. It wasn't until the 1990s, when the Israel Antiquities Authority stepped in, that the process of publication was advanced. Emmanuel Tove, emeritus professor in the Department of Bible at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, was nominated as chief editor, and the work was divided among international scholars. After more than 50 years, the publication of the Dead Sea Scrolls was, for the most part, completed in 2001 and accessible in academic libraries. The discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls provided valuable insight into the process of transmission of the now canonical texts, but also insight into how those texts were used and interpreted in the centuries around the turn of the era. Of particular interest have been texts that appear to have as one main goal the rewriting of the tradition. So today, we will explore the genre of rewritten Bible. To do this, let's briefly consider four key texts: the role of scribal activity in the process of transmission, and debates about how best to define this genre. We'll end with some general observations regarding textual authority at Qumran, which is the site where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, as well as how rewritten Bible texts fit into general interpretive practices at Qumran. It is important to note that scholars debate the appropriateness of the term Bible to describe these texts, because there was not an established canon of authoritative texts in the 2nd and 1st centuries BCE. The use of Bible is therefore anachronistic, and thus some scholars, like Sidney White Crawford and Molly Zahn, prefer the term scripture instead. For these scholars, scripture indicates that the rewritten texts were not definitively authoritative, but rather were authoritative to the author that chose to rewrite them. On the other hand, Geza Vermish has argued that, based on the textual evidence, it is possible to conclude that there was a fixed set of authoritative texts, possibly even by the 1st century BCE, that roughly corresponds to the canon of the Hebrew Bible today. In any event, Vermes argues that quibbling over these terms is little more than splitting hairs. As we discuss the genre rewritten Bible, I will return to four key texts: Jubilees, the Temple Scroll, the Genesis Apocryphon, and 4Q Reworked Pentateuch. 4Q Reworked Pentateuch is a scroll found at Qumran. The 4 indicates that it was found in the fourth cave that was excavated. The Q stands for Qumran. And Reworked Pentateuch is the name given the various fragments believed to be part of the one work. The names of the individual fragments that, when compiled, make up 4Q Reworked Pentateuch are 4Q158, that is the 158th fragment documented in the cave, and 4Q364 through 367. Jubilees was previously known, but only in an Ethiopic translation. Several fragmentary copies of the document were found at Qumran. Jubilees is a full-scale rewriting of Genesis and Exodus from creation up through the Exodus event. It is presented as divine revelation from the angel of the presence to Moses at Mount Sinai. It is concerned to structure time according to 49-year increments, which is why it has its name. According to Leviticus 25, every 49 or 50 years, depending on how you count and who you ask, is to be the Jubilee year where debts are forgiven, land is returned to the ancestral owners, and indentured Israelite slaves are freed. Jubilees also follows a 364-day solar calendar rather than the Babylonian lunar calendar that was adopted in post-exilic times. It is also very concerned to portray the patriarchs as following Torah. For example, Abraham is said to celebrate certain festivals that technically haven't been prescribed yet. The Temple Scroll is a rewriting of much of the legal texts of the Pentateuch. It also presents itself as divine revelation with God as the narrator rather than an intermediary. The scroll rearranges legal material according to themes, but it also introduces new legislation and harmonizes contradictions. Additionally, it includes detailed outlines for the construction of a new temple. Because it does not correspond to either the Wilderness Tabernacle or Solomon's Temple, it has been suggested that the plans are for an ideal temple. The Genesis Apocryphon is at least an Aramaic rewriting of portions of Genesis. I say at least because it is quite fragmentary. So fragmentary, in fact, that it is impossible to determine the full scope of the text. It clearly relies on traditions about Noah's birth, the myth of the Watcher, and the Flood, but it expands these stories. Noah, Enoch, and Lamech each tell their stories in the first person. Abraham's story begins in the first person, but ends in the third person. After that, the text breaks off. This story is concerned with the emotional drama of the text rather than some ideological concern, like an imposition of a solar calendar in Jubilees. The fourth text is comprised of the 5 manuscripts entitled Reworked Pentateuch. None of the manuscripts have any meaningful overlap with each other, and thus were early on considered to be different documents. The documents rearrange passages in the Pentateuch, typically according to theme. However, they also introduce new material. For example, Miriam's song at the Red Sea, which we discuss in our episode on Miriam in Season 2, and legislation about the festivals of wood and fresh oil. There is no change in voice or setting to indicate that the texts presented themselves as new compositions, but the texts are so fragmentary that definitive claims are really hard to defend. Scholars debate on exactly how to classify 4Q reworked Pentateuch, and as we'll see, this text is quite often excluded from the generic category of rewritten Bible. When beginning to think about defining the genre, scribal activity is often considered. Scribal intervention was assumed and acceptable. Individual scribes were editing, clarifying, and expanding texts based on their own individual memories, but more importantly, based on the cultural memory of their communities. When looking at the alterations in rewritten texts, George Brook argues that there are four aspects to the process. First, under the category embellishment and institutionalization, Brook argues that part of the technique is to smooth out the text, but also to make a claim within the scribe's community. Second, Brook notes a category, distortion and obligation, which he sees in Jubilees, imposition of its calendar. Third, he sees invention and reorganization happening. For example, in Genesis Apocryphon, Abram is justified in his lie that Sarai was his sister through a divine dream. Meanwhile, 4Q reworked Pentateuch and the Temple Scroll rearrange legal material thematically. Finally, Brook argues that omissions should be understood as forgetting. This is not intentionally negative, but indicates that the scribes were taking part in a selective reconstruction of their received tradition. These various aspects of rewriting have caused some to question whether a generic category is appropriate at all, or if, instead, it would be better to think of the process of rewriting. On one hand, thinking of a process rather than a genre gets scholars out of the work of trying to determine how best to define the parameters of the genre, and it takes into account the multiplicity of texts that use the Bible in some way as their starting point deviate from the text dramatically. On the other hand, maintaining the notion of a category is helpful in delimiting the particular texts that seem to have rewriting the biblical text in a particular way as one of their main goals. In an effort to delineate one end of the generic spectrum, Michael Segal has put forth some criteria for differentiating between copies of a biblical text and a rewriting of the text. First, he states that no translation can be a copy because copies will always be in the same language as their base text. That is to say that, for instance, the Septuagint is not a rewriting of the Hebrew text because the Septuagint is in a different language. So regardless of what changes the Septuagint might be making as the translation occurs, it should not be considered a rewriting, according to Michael Segal. Second, he notes that rewritten texts will often include a change in narrative voice and or setting. Jubilees, the Temple Scroll, and Genesis Apocryphon each have a different narrative voice than their base texts. And Jubilees is given a different narrative setting in that it is presented as being announced at Mount Sinai. Third, Segal argues that consideration of the scope of the text is also important. A copy of a biblical text will begin and end where its base text does. However, rewritten texts often stretch the boundaries of their base texts, thus creating a new literary unit. For instance, Jubilees cannot be considered a copy of Genesis because it extends into Exodus, but neither can it be considered a copy of Genesis and Exodus because it does not contain the whole of Exodus since it concludes at Mount Sinai. Fourth, rewritten texts will contain both abridgment and development, while copies tend not to omit as much material. Fifth, Segal argues that there is often a clear editorial layer, such as the imposition of the calendar in Jubilees. Finally, a rewritten text will sometimes mention its base text. This happens in Jubilees with reference to the first law. Overall, Segal stresses that copies and rewritten texts are both only moments in the process of transmission, even though he does think that marking these distinctions is important. 4Q Reworked Pentateuch is an excellent text for considering Segal's criteria. Molly Zahn has worked through his criteria and determined that 4Q Reworked Pentateuch is still notoriously difficult to categorize. On the one hand, there are no changes in narrative voice or setting, and thus the fragments might be considered copies. However, because of the fragmentary nature of the text, it is impossible to know the scope of the work or how much omission occurred. While much that has survived has been rearranged and thus appears to omit significant amounts of the text, it is also theoretically possible that those passages were simply relocated somewhere else. However, one manuscript contains portions of Genesis and Exodus, while another contains four of the five books of the Pentateuch. Should this be an indication in change of scope, and thus qualify as rewritten Bible? Another scholar has reviewed the way that the legal material, rather than the narrative, is handled in 4Q Reworked Pentateuch, and has suggested that the texts are either an entirely new way of handling biblical copies, or should be considered rewritten Bible. Moving away from Segal's criteria for determining between copy or new text, let's look at how various scholars have defined the genre and which texts get included in their definitions. Geza Vermesh is accredited with coining the term rewritten Bible. He viewed rewritten Bible as an interpretive process that included haggadic interpretation, that is, non-legal material, woven seamlessly into the narrative text. His definition was built around characteristics he noted in the Palestinian Targumim, the Aramaic paraphrase or interpretation of the Hebrew Bible. Pseudo-Philo's Biblical Antiquities, Josephus's Antiquities, and at the time, the recently discovered Genesis Apocryphon. More recently, Vermesh has criticized scholars for focusing so narrowly on texts from Qumran when there are more examples of the phenomenon available. Daniel Harrington and George Nicholsberg begin to move away from Vermesh in their definitions. Harrington's definition includes translations like Genesis Apocryphon, Josephus, and the Targumim, but Nicholsberg's does not. Harrington also includes the Temple Scroll, and as noted, the Temple Scroll is rewritten legal code. This text was not available at the time of Vermesh's initial writing, but he has later stated that rewritten legal code should also be included in the category. The loosening of their definition is most notable by their inclusion of texts that are based on the Bible or a biblical character, but that do not follow the biblical text. For them, this would include such texts as the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs and the Enoch literature. Part of the reasoning for this is that they view the process of rewriting as an important piece of defining the category of rewritten Bible. Moshe Bernstein, however, has criticized their definition for being so loose that it is almost useless. Moving in the opposite direction, Emmanuel Tov has restricted the category in ways that are practically incompatible with Vermesh. Tov differentiates between rewritten and reworked texts and rephrased texts. Rewritten or reworked texts follow biblical language, but might include some forms of reorganization. Ultimately, there is minor scribal intervention. Tov would include 4Q Reworked Pentateuch as rewritten Bible. Rephrased texts are work that demonstrate major intervention. Thus, he would exclude Jubilees from the category of rewritten Bible. George Brook has taken on the question of rewritten Bible many times. In his entry in the Encyclopedia of the Dead Sea Scrolls, he notes that rewritten Bible includes texts that follow their biblical text closely, but also add to it in ways that are more than supplementary. He viewed it as a sort of umbrella term for a type of intertextual activity that prioritized one text over another. Later, he revisited the genre by considering insights from genre theory. He notes that no genre is fixed and that no text can ever fully meet the criteria of the genre. Further, he notes that the inclusion of a text into a genre changes the nature of the genre. So he suggests that one way to think about the genre is not to think about formal features, but to think about what it is the text sets out to do. He argues that rewritten texts work to contemporize traditions and speak to the community's immediate concerns. This enhances the authority of the base text by making them relevant, but also confers authority on the rewritten text because it is claiming correct interpretation. Sidney White Crawford argues that rewritten Bible texts rework, rephrase, add, abridge, or interpret a text which is now part of the Jewish canon. These texts, despite the reworkings, still follow their base texts closely. Notably, she sees 4Q Reworked Pentateuch as rewritten Bible because it adds unique material unattested elsewhere. She views these additions as disqualifying the text from being considered simply a copy of the Pentateuch. Moshe Bernstein's definition includes narrative and/or legal material that have interpretation woven into the text implicitly. He argues that this would need to be a comprehensive or broad scope project. He does not consider translations to be rewritten Bible because one would be forced to include any translation that was not hyper-literal into the genre. He also argues that a book that was or would become a biblical text should not be considered in the category, thus eliminating Deuteronomy and Chronicles. He does, however, note the difficulty here because one person's rewritten text is another person's Bible. Molly Zahn is the last scholar we'll look at. She, like Brooke, looks to genre theory for insight on how to discuss rewritten Bible. She finds the genre label useful so long as it is viewed flexibly. First, she notes that this particular label says nothing about form or content, but rather indicates something about the textual history of the document. Because of this, she finds it important to stress that a work can fall under more than one generic category. Second, she suggests that thinking in terms of a spectrum might be helpful and suggests the use of prototypes. As an example, often a blue jay is used as a prototypical example of a bird, but that does not mean that penguins and emus are not also birds. Rather, it means that a blue jay fits the category better than penguins or emus and is a more useful model for the category. Similarly, she argues that it might be useful to think of texts falling along a spectrum of rewritten Bible, with a text like Jubilees or Pseudophilo serving as prototypes, but including room for texts like 4Q reworked Pentateuch at one end of the spectrum and the Targumim at another. Finally, she notes that there are three elements that justify the use of rewritten Bible as a genre. One, the text is a new work. Two, the text is concerned with interpretation. And three, the new text is situated in the same discourse as the original. A related concept to the discussion of genre is how to determine the authority or status of a text at Qumran. James Vanderkam has suggested three criteria for determining if a text was authoritative. First, does the text present itself that way? Jubilees and the Temple Scroll seem to present themselves as divine revelation by their choice of narrator. Genesis Apocryphon does not make any such internal claims in the extant portions. 4Q reworked Pentateuch mimics the biblical language of its base texts and thus might be attempting to claim the same authority, but there are not explicit claims. Second, is the text cited in another text? Jubilees is cited by the Damascus document, a sectarian document that was found at Qumran, indicating that it was highly esteemed by the scribe. There is possible and debatable overlap between 4Q reworked Pentateuch and the Temple Scroll, but it is difficult to date these texts to know which would be the source for the other. Third and final, is the text the subject of a pesher or commentary? In the extant documents, none of the four texts I have considered are subjects for a pesher. Thus, overall, it is difficult to pin down exactly how authoritative any of these texts were in their communities, though their survival should suggest that they were at least important documents. Our discussion of genre has only focused on one form of interpretation at Qumran. Rewritten Bible is unique in that the interpretation is built into the text, and often that renders modern scholars unable to determine what is interpretation and what is an otherwise unattested tradition. In the case of the Pesherim, the distinction is made much more clearly. Pesherim are lemmatic commentaries wherein the biblical text is cited and a stated interpretation is presented. An example of the difference in these types of interpretation can be seen in the prohibition of uncle-niece marriage. The Damascus document cites the biblical prohibition of nephew-aunt marriage and states outright that it should be read inclusively to prohibit uncle-niece marriage. The Temple Scroll, on the other hand, rewrites the prohibition into the text without any indication that it is an additional interpretation. This, however, should not suggest that all internal interpretation is done the same way. Ancient readers were clearly uncomfortable with the fact that Abram lies that Sarai is his sister. Jubilees changes the text to say that Abram was distressed that Sarai was taken from him, thus omitting the lie, while Genesis Apocryphon justifies the lie through a divine dream. Overall, the category of rewritten Bible, Emmanuel Tove's restrictive definition notwithstanding, tends to include any text in the same language that follows the biblical-based text closely, yet selectively, while also adding to the story in some sort of interpretive or dramatic way. The debate seems to be mostly around whether and to what extent translations should be included and how radically a text must depart from its base text to be excluded from the genre. This question will not likely be settled anytime soon. But Moshe Bernstein is correct to note that we must continue to wrestle with the definition in a way that is scholastically useful and precise. So before we close out this episode, I do want to briefly discuss Deuteronomy and Chronicles, as they are canonized examples of this phenomenon, and most people are more familiar with them than they are with Jubilees, the Temple Scroll, and 4Q reworked Pentateuch. Deuteronomy is a Greek word coming from deutero, meaning second, and nomos, meaning law. So it is a restatement of the law with a different theological focus. Deuteronomy's speeches assert that the covenant requires certain behavior from the people. Obedience to the commands will result in blessing, while disobedience will result in punishment. Overall, the punishments are built into the structure of the covenant. However, the exile is later understood to be punishment for disobedience, and that is not outlined in Deuteronomy. Keeping the law is a response to God's grace, not an attempt to earn it. This is an important point to keep in mind, as there is a certain Christian tendency to make out Jewish folks as trying to earn God's favor. Deuteronomy teaches that Jewish folks are born into God's favor, and that obedience to God's law is one way to respond to such grace. This theological perspective of obedience resulting in blessing and disobedience resulting in punishment is also found in Joshua, Judges, the books of Samuel, and the books of Kings, which all narrate the stories of Israel's life according to Deuteronomy's vision. These texts are collectively known as the Deuteronomistic history. One example of the rewriting that Deuteronomy does of Exodus can be found in the details surrounding the giving of the Ten Commandments. Deuteronomy's version is shorter and found in 5:1 through 22, while Exodus's account takes up chapters in 19:1 through 20:22. Exodus's Mount Sinai is called Mount Horeb in Deuteronomy, indicating that the mountain was known by different names in different communities. In both accounts, the actual commands are written in first person with God speaking. However, while Exodus gives God direct speech concerning rules in preparation for Moses' ascent up the mountain, Deuteronomy summarizes those items and puts them on the lips of Moses, recounting what he was told. The books of Chronicles were written after the exile, probably in the 4th century BCE, and the author is conventionally called the chronicler. In the Hebrew Bible, Chronicles is one work, like Samuel and Kings, and holds a more priestly point of view than the Deuteronomistic histories. Chronicles is largely parallel to Samuel and Kings, though it excludes 2 Samuel 9 through 20 regarding David's taking of Bathsheba and Absalom's revolt. It also mostly ignores material on the northern kingdom, holding the view that Judah is the legitimate nation. Chronicles also extends the story beyond captivity through to the return home. The sources for Chronicles seem to be an earlier edition of Samuel and Kings, but it also relies on Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Joshua, Samuel, and Ruth for genealogies. Psalm 96, 105, and 106 are cited in 1 Chronicles 16. There are also references to Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Zechariah. There is a minority position that holds that Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles are all independently written but rely on the same source material. In its rewriting, Chronicles seems to hold certain perspectives and priorities. This might be that editorial layer that some scholars say is definitive of the genre. The book has a special loyalty to the Levites and includes singers, gatekeepers, and bakers among the Levites. The tasks of the Levites included teaching, handling holy objects, preparing the rows of showbread, and serving as judges and scribes, as well as leading in singing and praise. Chronicles treats David and Solomon as equals, often omitting negative material about them. Instead, it centers on the story of the building of the temple and installation of its personnel, and it views David and Solomon's reigns as the ideal time in Israelite history. The chronicler takes the Deuteronomistic history's theological lens and makes it more immediate. Faithful royal behavior results in many children, building projects, a well-equipped army, victory in war, cultic reforms, and tributes from the nations. Wicked kings get God's wrath, defeat in battle, disease, or conspiracy. While it is tempting for modern readers to view this practice as problematic, that just wasn't the case for ancient Jewish folk. A deliberate change in the text does not indicate that the author was trying to be misleading or malicious. Changes may either be the creation of the author, reflecting his own tendentious concerns or perspectives, or may indicate that the author has reformulated his text on the basis of source material not preserved in the canonical biblical corpus. Rewritten Bible is an interesting category of texts that, more than anything, indicates the fluidity of traditions and the diversity of communities who were using and adapting these documents for their own particular situations. Well, grandmas, that's that. I know this episode is a lot of material and that I probably referenced a lot of texts and scholarship that you might be unfamiliar with. So please feel free to email me at notyourgrandmapodcast@gmail.com and I will do my best to help answer those questions. So thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend about me. Hopefully this episode has provided some interesting food for thought. How texts were used in the ancient world versus today is really important for thinking about the place of canonical and non-canonical documents in our own faith journeys. I personally think this episode pairs well with our episode on inerrancy from season one and a nice glass of Merlot or hot water with lemon, depending on what kind of grandma you are. So please, if you are so inclined, take a moment, give me a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you have any feedback that you think needs immediate attention, questions, or suggestions for future episodes, shoot me an email. All I ask is that you be kind. I'm a real person after all. Again, thank you for listening. Stay safe out there. Stay home if you can. Wear your mask. Get your vaccine. Amen. And Selah. Catch you later.